The American dream has become a nightmare. Signs of the time are on cardboard, on corners in town. Like a cancer that's silently spreading, there's an unspoken fear. We're on our way down. We must take America back. Main Street to Wall Street, cities and states, Washington, D.C. Before it's too late, there's not long. We need leaders who lead us, not stick us and bleed us, then ransom our future and our children's, that's wrong. We must take America back as liberty weeps, our forefathers spin in their graves. Pray God will bless some way out of this mess. We must take America back. Lord knows they'll try.
Yes, guys. You're tuned in to the National Intel Report, John Stad Miller's Hour. I am your guest host for this evening. And wow, guys, I'm glad you are here with us, tuned in to this primetime hour, that guest show for you. But first, I want to say, guys, you should be supporting our sponsors. Please, we got to keep the radio station going. It's going to take the efforts of all of you fine listeners and callers and overall supporters because, well, you know, freedom isn't free, and we're definitely going to have to, you know, keep supporting ourselves. You know, we're a bunch of conservatives here, concerned citizens, especially in the day and age of censorship. So definitely get on to TLBTalk.com. That's our brand new freedom speech social network. It's like Facebook, but without all the libtards and the censorship. Yeah. And so that person laughing there, our guest here with us today, we have a legend, a real media legend. By all rights, my senior and predecessor, as far as this media thing is concerned. Yes, we have Layla Paul here with us. How are you doing, Layla?
Great. I'm really glad to be talking to you, V. I want you to know I signed up as your friend last night. I rejoined TLB Talk, and I noticed that in February you had sent out an invitation to friend. And by then I had already pulled back out. I thought, no, being the cancer crab that I am, I just had crawled back into my shell. And I saw when I joined back last night and I saw your comments, and of course, I accepted your offer of friendship. Thank you. And I'm delighted, honored to be here with you today. I think your rationalization, your explanation of your mission is very impressive, very humane, and I deeply admire your goal. And the fact that you're putting yourself out there, that's something that everybody has to do, everyone should do if they have any sense of responsibility and respect the principles of freedom, especially freedom of speech, because without that, there is no other freedom. And we've been gagged for far too long all over, not only in the U.S., but here in Canada. So TLB Talk, RBN, great partnership. And thank you for having me. So I'll let you take it away.
What a winning endorsement. Well, this is definitely a proud moment in my duration of what I do here, this is definitely a noteworthy and a milestone, I think, for a legend such as yourself to give such high praises. I must be doing something right.
Well, I don't know that I, you know, there are some who would say I'm notorious, not so much a legend, but if you want to call me a legend, I'll accept that.
Well, absolutely. You've got credits a mile long here. You know, I have to, when I talk to business partners and future potential business partners and broadcasters and what have you, you know, I gotta roll out my own red carpet. But with you, it's just, it's already laid out. And it's much longer than mine, I can tell you. I mean, just from, I mean, I don't want to steal your thunder here, but your first TV job, 1972.
Yes.
I mean, CBC TV news anchor. I mean, oh my goodness. I mean,
actually, let me stop you there, because my Canadian experience is the lowest point in my career.
Oh, I definitely have to go into that, because I do have some Canadian friends that listen to the show, and I'm a regular, I guess you would call it, panel host on the Red Pill Nation.
Oh.
With Naroki 5 and Steve Urson. There is a Canadian show, Canadian Red Pill Nation. So, yeah, I would like to. Yeah, just please go ahead and tell us your bio from start.
All right. Well, I always listened to TV news as I sat by my father. We'd watch it, and that was when I realized the power of video with audio. I was too young to recognize that editors controlled things. I do remember the bias that crept through. What I did not recognize at the time was that Canadian media was probably even more controlled by Zionist enterprises than even the U.S., although very likely they were equivalent. But I remember shuddering when I heard them referring. This is the bias that crept in. We're talking in the 50s or 60s. They would talk about, oh, the Arabs are rattling their sabers again. And then they would proceed. Imagine that at a time when they were supposed to be objective. We know today that they no longer hide the fact of their bias. In order to work in TV news, I knew that one of the most intractable issues was the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. So I went to Beirut in 1971, did some research while I was there, had some fascinating experiences that we can go into another time, if you like, or later on. And then 2 years later, I went back to Canada, completed my degree. I had lived in Montreal before that, and I lived the life of the bon vivant, so attending classes was not an option. Montreal was just, it was just too beautiful, too exciting a place with clubs and restaurants. So I thought I had to go to a backwater in order to focus on studies and complete my degree. And although Windsor was not a backwater, the University of Windsor, it had been Assumption University, and I believe it was the Jesuit brothers who had started it. As Assumption College, then it became University of Windsor. Wonderful education there, the best. And there I met my husband, an American of some European ancestry, but also Chippewa in the U.S. and Ojibwa in Canada, as they're known. So he had a very good perspective on many things. While I was a student, we wouldn't date, but once I had graduated, we began to date, and soon we were married. I had tried repeatedly to get jobs in Canada, but they would snicker. A woman being a reporter, news coming out of a woman's mouth would sound like gossip. The executive producer of the TV news.
Wow.
Yeah, that was 1971, 72. No, it would be 71, around there. But yeah, I was just appalled. And he was the executive producer. It was then CKLW-TV, and it was later bought by the CBC. It was right on the border with Detroit.
So 1971, 1972, that sounds like something you would hear, like watching, I don't know, like a 1940s gangster movie or something.
You know what? That's what it was like. And when I was trying to educate them about the Palestinian-Israeli issue, they called me, well, then I was labeled not only a woman who didn't belong in a newsroom, but I was now a Palestinian unspoken equivalent with, woo, terrorist. Because at that time, the propaganda was out and Palestinianism was tantamount to being a terrorist. You didn't have to do anything. All you had to do was just say, I was born in Palestine, or what is known as Palestine. But it started when I went in, when you'd go into liquor stores at the time, things weren't out in the open as they are now. You would have to go to a list, find the product you wanted to buy, write it down on a slip of paper, and take it to a guy who was behind the counter who would then go back and get the product you were buying. When I put my books down on the desk as I was waiting for him, he came back and saw a book on broadcast journalism. Why are you reading that? I said, because I'm going to be a TV news reporter. And he burst out laughing, saying, ha, news coming out of a woman's mouth would sound like gossip. Walked into the newsroom and I said, guys, you'll never believe what I just was told. And then when I said it, the executive producer, I won't mention his name, except that he was a wiry guy who later became a member of the provincial parliament. And of course, as that, he became very friendly to Arabs, although then he was extremely hostile. He said, well, he's absolutely right. Women don't belong in newsrooms. We guys can't swear. We can't do our thing. Women just don't belong here. And yeah, news coming out of a woman's mouth would be gossip.
It's like an episode of Mad Men or something.
Yeah, it was terrible. Now, the rest of the guys in that newsroom were great. The cameramen, the editors, they were wonderful. Some of them were very biased against me. I remember one episode where there was something called Caravan, the cultural caravan that was put on by the Multicultural Center of Windsor and Essex County. And one of the British heritage women in the newsroom came in laughing. She said, guy, you'll never believe who's out there. A bunch of Pakis and Wogs want us to cover their event as though it's news. And of course, my back stiffened. And one of the other reporters who was a little more intuitive and more knowledgeable looked at me and I could see that he was startled. Shortly after, she invited me to her place for tea and I knew why she had done it. But I didn't. I don't know if people know that the British always referred to Africans, Indians, and Arabs as wogs, which came from the word polywog.
I was going to ask. Okay. Wait, hold on. Polywog is a Pokemon.
I don't know what it is now, but I'm talking about way back. I don't know anything about
polywog.
Polywog. Wow. Yeah, they used to make black dolls, and they would call that and that was their excuse. Oh, we didn't mean anything disparaging by it. It's just the name of this black rag doll that we have that we call polywog. But they used to call Arabs in particular polywog. So there was this huge buildup that was starting even then against all Arabs and Palestinians in particular, because they were the ones who were obviously dispossessed by the Bolshevik Zionist movement. And since they had now also gained supremacy in all of the major institutions in North America and the Western world in general, they were the ones that they had to target first as the enemy. Eventually, and I'll slip this in now, it's too early to be saying it, but it came out recently in Haaretz, they finally acknowledged it in an Israeli newspaper that there were Jews that were actually Arabs, Arab Jews. They call them Mizrahim, the Sephardi Jews or Mizrahim Jews, but they're the ones living in the Arab countries. And they were basically the same genetic stock. They went into Palestine in preparation and were installing typhoid salmonella, the bacteria, not the typhus disease, but the typhoid salmonella fever. They were installing that at the bacterium in some wells, well waters and also in selective foods. My mother ended up coming down with typhoid fever. And just a little before I was born, I was lucky that I was born long enough. It was about a year later that I was born. But it was common. I had seen affidavits 20 years ago where Arab Jews had acknowledged doing this. But they had been planning the invasion of Palestine. As I tell them, Palestine was lost in the mid-1800s when the Rothschilds decided they wanted Palestine as their global headquarters. And when I say Zionist, I am not speaking about all of the people who today call themselves Jews and have every right to be proud of who they are and to practice their religion in peace. So I'm opposed to the idea of saying Jews, Jews, Jews. It's really the political leaders. Now, of course, if you're born as a Jew into a strictly Zionist family, you're going to end up being indoctrinated and you absorb that into your identity. However, that does not negate the fact that many people who practice Judaism, whether it's, and the three religions today are modern inventions of the 1800s. And you can add to that Chabad Lubavitch, which was created in Poland in the 1700s. But whether it's Orthodox or Reform or Conservative, most of them were firmed up in the 1800s in Europe. So they aren't really the original religion that was practiced in the land of Judah. And I
I talk about this all the time. They're not even the original people. I mean, we talk about the European Jews and then the, the African Hebrew. Totally different people.
Yes.
They don't want us to know that, of course.
No, they don't acknowledge it. There's no way. They want to cover it up. And they actually deny it. That's one of the major things. And the thing that they fear the most is being identified as descendants of the Khazari Jews, which they are. Which they are, most of them.
Yes. And I'm looking, I'm having a hard time with this polywog thing. just searching it. Okay, I'm getting mostly of tadpole or toad, yeah. But I do have one entry out of many that talks about it being. It rhymes with Nog, which of course you had the term Nick Nog.
Oh, I didn't know about that one. Yeah.
So multiple, it's meaning multiple of whatever those people. So yeah. I'm learning a lot today.
Well, the internet has been cleansed. I mean, we know who controls the internet today. It's not just the internet. It's what gets published. What gets distributed, what is allowed to be, if something is made into a documentary, where it's allowed to be viewed and when it's taken down. Everything is cleansed to go along with the ideology. And it's not the Jewish people that are doing it. It is the elite who also controls the Jews, whether or not they realize it. They have been absorbed into the hive that I consider basically is what they're basically the drones. I don't mean to be disparaging in any way, because people, they do have the right.
They do good business. They're kind of like the oil in the machine. Things kind of run efficiently. I mean, there's a lot of woke black, historians, whatever, they're talking about how the Jews were, selling Africans out of Africa during the slave trade. And, you see the names on the ledgers, of who these people were. And it's like, but they weren't the ones catching them. They weren't the ones actually, they just happened to take control of the industry. They owned the boats. And so they went ahead and took control of the industry.
Yep.
So
I
do want to skip this commercial. No, I want to skip this commercial.
Okay. All right.
Well, I'll let you keep going. Go ahead.
Okay, the other thing, too, is we should not excuse the Arab Muslims. Now, they were also good for the black Africans because they often actually, they had harems, beautiful women from all over the world. But when they found, they went into Africa, obviously, but they also had geographers and historians that recorded their activity. And they always spoke of them as being hardworking, honest, and good-natured people. And when they worked, they always sang and danced in rhythm. That was the one thing I remember one of the Arab historiographers recorded. It seemed natural to them. Now, rarely they would take some and sell them as slaves as well. But most of the time, they incorporated the Africans into their households. That's why you see a lot of dark-skinned Arabs. Because in its origin, the Arabs actually came down from the north. Those who became Arabs. Now remember, there really is no such thing as a single Arab identity. I don't care what they say. The Arabs actually obliterated the original identity of many, many heterogeneous peoples who were in the Southwest Asian Peninsula, that being what is called today the Arabian Peninsula. They started conquering one tribe after another, and the Arab language, which is absolutely beautiful and positively eloquent and expresses things that cannot be found in words in English. But they did one place at a time. There were numerous languages, and a good person to, he's on YouTube, is Ahmed Al-Jalad, AhmadAl-Jallad. He documents from a lot of the graffiti that was found in numerous sites, thousands of them, all the different scripts that were written in the various dialects or languages of the region. There was the Himyaritic, the Safaitic. And most importantly, most prominently, was the Aramean that was spoken in the northwest of the Arabian Peninsula. In the northwest, it was the Nabataean Kingdom. And they were, again, probably the best merchants in the world, because they were eventually, they got a deal with Rome when Rome couldn't defeat them because Petra was impenetrable. Petra was like Fort Knox. It was built right into the hillside. So you could not get hold of their wealth. They could not be defeated. Finally, from what I've read, despite what people say, they weren't defeated by Rome. Rome offered them exclusive license to distribute their spices and other products within the entire Roman Empire if they would just ally with Rome. And the Nabataeans were gifted in so many ways. They had secret routes that they would not reveal to anyone, obviously in India as well as Africa. And one of the things that they also, that made them very wealthy, was they created a cement that was impermeable. So when there were flash floods in the rare instances of rainfall, they were able to dig cisterns from this particular concrete that they invented, and then they would hide it so only they and their people would know. So when the caravans, be they camel caravans or donkey caravans, that came through, they were in desperate need of water, and they could sell them the water at any price they wanted. So the Nabataeans were extremely gifted. They used the Aramean language. Now, my people, we never called ourselves Palestinians. Most of the people in that area always identified by their tribal affiliation or their village. We were, and I believe the original name of Bethlehem was Tel Elahim, which was located during the kingdom of probably the Chaldeans of Babylon, if not under Sumer as well, because it was just southwest of Ur, and it was called Tel Elahim. It used to be a very notable archaeological site, but was destroyed in 2003 when the U.S. invaded Iraq, one of the invasions of Iraq, and thereby destroying and stealing all of the artifacts. But the migrants of Tel Elahim ended up going to, and Bethlehem is a hilltop town that is a little bit higher even than Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, its name probably originates from the time of the Chaldeans in Babylon. Ur means city. Shalem means light, peace. Ur Shalem, Jerusalem. Remember, there was no J back then. Ur Shalem actually originates way back with the people of either Sumeria or of the Chaldeans of Babylon.
I not to get religious or anything, but I have often brought up that little historical fact there in the etymology that there is no J sounding sounds. So, and I ask a lot of preachers, and so where's Jesus fit in if there is no J sounds? You just imagine the kind of answers I would get. Speaking of the etymology that you're going through, do I sense that you speak Aramaic or Arabic or something?
When we left Bethlehem before the British pulled out, so I was just a year and 10 months old. So the only reason I have an excellent memory. So it's been like 65, 67 years since I heard it spoken, but it still is in my head. Every now and then it comes up. So yes, I knew the words. I still know the words. But the thing is, there was a lot of evolution of the Aramaic language. The very, very old imperial would have been spoken with a chaff, where the Arabs today pronounce ka, we would have said chaff. They're still using it in the Gulf because it was also used by the Persian Empire under Cyrus the Great, or Horesh, I think the would have been his name in Persian, of the Achaemenid dynasty. It might have been under him that it became the lingua franca. And the lingua franca only means that people who spoke different languages as their native language adopted a language so they could communicate with one another. But all of the dialects that are Semitic are very similar. And the Aramaic would be, I think, the mother of all Semitic languages. And the Hebrew did not exist. Hebrew actually might be a Chaldean word that means they came over the river or they went over the river. And it comes from the Chaldean. There's a lot of things that were misinterpreted by the Greeks, and then they were misinterpreted again when they were first the Greeks translated from different Aramaic scripts of biblical scripts, the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. There was more than one Aramaic record of what was happening at the time. Then
it's funny that you say that. I had a girlfriend who said Hebrew means you bring me coffee. It's like, oh, okay, that's what that means.
Actually, I think it's Hebity or Ebity. I think they use the iron, which, by the way, modern Hebrew is not even remotely related to actual biblical Hebrew. And the biblical Hebrew, when I first started to study it with some Jews of Israel, they were still trying to use the biblical pronunciation, the old Aramaic. But since then, they found it too difficult. They have dropped the ayin. They no longer pronounce the ha. They pronounce it as a ha. Mm-hmm. And no, it doesn't mean that you're gathering up a bunch of mucus. That's how to make a sound. No, it's closer to the Germanic ha, bach. You don't say bach, you say bach. So it's a softer sound. They have dropped. And also the most telling that the modern Hebrew is influenced by the Scandinavian languages as well as the old Germanic languages is the resh. Can you hear the difference in the trill? Resh, when it's the tip of the tongue. That is the way all Mediterranean and Semitic languages should be pronounced when it's r. However, because they pronounce it with the Germanic or Scandinavian accent, they use the uvular r, which is made with the uvula, as in French or many German languages or dialects, and also some of the Scandinavians. And really, they were speaking Yiddish, not Hebrew. Okay, now we're going into a break again.
Yes, we're going to commercial break for all this time. Stay on the line. I got lots more questions for you.
All right.
And we'll be back, guys. Stay tuned.
Truth! You can't handle the truth! You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Real news, real talk, real people. Because you can handle the truth.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen planned to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile oxysilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from Simply Clean Foods, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters.
Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on long-term food storage in the rotating sponsors banners to support RBN.
Simply Clean Foods. Do it today.
You're tuned in to the National Intel Report, the real talk radio show.
Okay, all right, we're back.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, Leila Paul here with us. And, well, you're a wealth of knowledge, but I want to get back to your credits here.
Okay.
I mean, you're sort of like, I don't know, are you the first female TV broadcaster?
Well, let me put it this way. When I interviewed Edward Said when I was working in Vancouver for the Canadian Brothel Company. The CBC Broadcasting Company. I say that because sexuality, they assume that part of the job when you work for the CBC is you're supposed to be provided with sexual playmates. And I'll get to that later if you like at another time.
Okay.
Because I ended up in a 13-year dispute with legal dispute with the CBC. They were determined to destroy the ability of people to sue them. But Jan Gomeshi was taken to court. But anyway, off on that. When I was working in Vancouver, I interviewed Edward Said. And when I introduced myself as Leila Paul, he said, "Leila, where did you get that name?" I said, "Well, it's Palestinian." He said, "Are you Palestinian?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, you're the very first of all the people who've interned me in the U.S. and Canada. You're the very first Palestinian I've ever met. And this was as late as 87. Now, I don't know if you're aware of who Edward Said is. Unfortunately, he's now dead. He died of leukemia. But he was a positively brilliant man at New York. I think it was Columbia University in New York. And he was a tremendous champion for truth and for uncovering the biases against what he called the Orientalism of what the English, the British created, of the English in particular. I shouldn't say, shouldn't blame all Brits. The English created of the whole Eastern world, the Middle East, which really is a misnomer because it's not the Middle East of anywhere unless you're in Britain. So it's a geocentric, imperial designation. But yeah, so I guess I would have been amongst the first. Certainly,
well,
Edward
you made
Said.
Your first appearance on CBC News in 1985. I was born in 1985.
you're young enough to be my grandson. I think, what are you, 32, 33?
No, I'm 37. Just turned.
37. Okay, well, you're certainly young enough to be my son, if not my grandson.
You're like the Joan of Arc. You're trailblazer, you know? It's like Martin Luther King. You're like amongst those cast of people that really pushed human rights forward.
I tried doing it, not in an aggressive or militaristic way. I have to tell you, when I was in Beirut in 1971, the PFLP, who did the hijackings that resulted in so many copycat hijackings and the transportation security, transportation safety bureau, whatever, and all of its security proceedings. A lot of that is blamed on Leila Khaled. And so when I was there, they wanted to make me the next Leila Khaled star, the hijacker. They were called by, at the time, the Soviet Union, who was financing a lot of it or training them because they all were in Moscow. They were labeled by the sheiks that they approached, because then at that time the sheiks were ignorant, they weren't educated. They were called the shepherds of the sky. So they got their funding from the sheiks and their training from the Soviets. But anyway, they tried to recruit me and I said, no, I'm just here to learn. I want to be a reporter. Then I was counter-recruited by the CIA and another man that I thought was British intelligence. 20 years later, my husband told me, no, I know that story. That man was not British intelligence. He was actually a South African working for Mossad. So evidently, my husband, who had refused to date me because I was a student, was actually, he claims he was not working a low-level worker for the CIA. He says a friend of his from the state police in Michigan said, you're at the university where she is. She was in Beirut in 71. She comes to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in 73. Check on her, make sure she's not a risk. He was apparently there to ensure that the largest Arab or Middle Eastern community in the Detroit-Windsor area was not a threat to the U.S.
Your husband was kind of put into a handler position.
I think he married me without their blessing. And I don't think he insisted later. He would never have revealed it except that at that point he had a successive neuroconcussion disease. It's now called chronic concussive disease disorder, but at the time they labeled it as Parkinsonism. So either the disease or the medication removes the inhibitions that are usually controlled by the frontal lobes. And when I was being recruited again in 1991, Yasser Arafat's brother was phoning me, you have a duty to your people. You must come and work. You must come to Cairo and Geneva and help us get medical care. And I said, no, I've got sick family members. I'm going to stay in Canada. I'll help from here only for medical purposes. Then when I hung up, my husband said, you may still be under surveillance. Don't even talk to him. I said, what do you mean surveillance? And then he told me. And
well,
then of course,
our situations
out.
Are kind of similar. dealt with the handler situation, and actually, I literally had, well, this very attractive, dark-haired lady, she, all over me. I did my best to ignore her. When I ignored her, I found that my electrical devices were being hacked. And so, like, for a while, I had to talk to her. Things would go okay. And so, you know what? You know, you ask a lot of questions, and you're very insisting, and you're very, so romantic. Oh, thank you for these unsolicited nudes. Wow, these are great. Oh, well, it's like, you know what? Who do you work for? And after about three weeks of me reverse interrogating her, she finally told me she was, she was Israel Defense Force intelligence.
They're all over. They're in every intelligence agency throughout the world.
So she went from me, I said, you know, bye-bye. She went from me to another host of another different Red Pill show that I was affiliated with, and I ended up turning my intelligence over to them. Guy was heartbroken. And so I totally blew up her spot. So, people, this stuff really goes on.
It's not as glamorous as the old James Bond movies used to portray them, but yeah, it goes on in very clumsy, awkward ways. And now I'm jumping all over, and I shouldn't be doing that, but it's very hard. There's just so much, and there are some key points that I want to get to. This was after I had given up my career in 1990. I walked away August 1990. It was a nightmare. I had a horrible experience at the CBC in Vancouver. I worked for the CBC first first it was CKLW, and then it was taken over by the CBC, but I couldn't get a job there once the CBC got in. So I ended up working for the Multicultural Council of the Windsor and Essex County, and the only benefit of that was that I began to interview the MP, Member of Parliament, for that region that we were in Windsor. And he was a wonderful man, Mark McGuigan. And I was just looking at his book recently where he talks about how Menachem Begin tried to persuade Pierre Trudeau to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. But Pierre Trudeau was too slick and disliked Menachem Begin. Trump, of course, fell for Nathan Netanyahu's pressures. Anyway, so while I was in Windsor, I couldn't get a job in TV news again, because by then the executive producer, who had said news coming out of a woman's mouth would sound like gossip, agreed with that guy at the alcohol store. The LCBO is what it's called here. I can't remember what the LCBO stands for. Liquor Control Board. Anyway, you're getting the crackling I'm getting?
Yeah, I think it's cleared up. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. But anyway, once my husband and I married, at first he approached me after ignoring me when we had met at parties, and he said he doesn't date students. Then when I came back from Israel, he just was all over me, had to take me here, had to take me there. We dated every day. Of course, by then I had graduated, and I was sticking around to do some post-grad work, but I didn't find anything I really enjoyed, because my brothers were dying, and I just didn't want to go back to Montreal. It was turmoil there because of the political threats of secession from the Quebec government, the Quebec secessionists, the FLQ. Anyway, so my husband wanted to know, what's it like to travel? I've never traveled. What's it like in Israel? Blah, 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 questions like that. It didn't even not for a moment did occur to me, because when I was at the Hebrew University in 1973, I didn't feel like I was being followed. I was given all sorts of liberty. I was at the new Mount Scopus campus that had just been confiscated from Palestinians, who swore at me as I walked across campus because the builders were still there finishing it up. And I didn't bother to say, I understand what you're saying. I am a Talahma. I know your language. I didn't say anything, but I felt ashamed. But still, I had a wonderful time at the Hebrew U. And from there, I went to Bethlehem and visited my first cousins, came back to Canada, and went back to university. And suddenly, my husband took a huge interest in me. 6 months later, I think we were married. And I never for a moment did it ever occur to me that he had started out being asked to watch me. He also, to be honest, and I don't want to hurt his reputation, but he also used to report back to who the draft dodgers were. So either he was working for the Michigan State Police and giving them information, who were then transmitting it to the FBI, who were then transmitting it to whoever else wanted it. That's what was going on. Now, many years later, 20 years later in 1989, Fathi Arafat came to Vancouver, tried to recruit me. I said no. Again, when in 1991, after I'd left the business and had no reason not to go to Geneva or Cairo, which sounds glamorous, but it would have been very risky. I said, no, I've got sick family members. I have to look after them. I'm not going to leave them in the hands of strangers. I had a mother who was dying, the last of my three brothers who was dying. I had a husband who was sick with a type of Parkinsonism because they didn't know how to correctly diagnose it. And I had a son, a teenage son, and I said, I'm not leaving them. And he pulled out, Fathi Arafat pulled out a huge wad of USD bills. I don't know if they were $100 bills, couldn't have been $1,000 bills, but he pulled them out and he said, what will it take to convince you? And I started to cry, and he didn't understand why. That was when I knew there was corruption within the ranks of what I thought were the champions of the Palestinian cause. And I had no problems after that believing when my husband said, stay away from them, they're trouble. But Let's go back now to, I came back to University of Windsor, got my degree, couldn't get a job. Then when my husband and I, he was taking a sabbatical and he was going to he was born in Hulbert, Michigan, in the county, in Chippewa County, population 450. So as a boy, he used to hunt for the family food. So he was very familiar with firearms. He was also an athlete. He was the state champion in a number of athletics, four-letter man in college, which is probably how he got so much brain damage, so many concussions. But anyway, we went there, and I ended up working. We settled in Marquette, where he did his sabbatical at the Northern Michigan University. I worked for the WNMU, the PBS TV station. Wonderful. I look back on it now and I miss it terribly. But then I got offered a job by the commercial TV station, WLUC, which was at that time the only TV station in the Upper Peninsula. So we covered the whole UP. It was a wonderful job. I loved it. It was probably one of my favorite jobs. I did everything. I mean, I was a reporter. I would shoot film. Because we were using the Canon Scopic at the time, the silent. Then we got to the sound system. Then we had video cameras. And when we were using film, I would chemically process the films. I would cut the film literally and do my own soundtrack, program the Chiron. I would do the weather. I would anchor the show with a great guy, Brian Yarrow, who was a wonderful guy to work with. He ended up going to New Mexico. That was a tremendous experience because I learned everything there. And then I got hired in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which was a big jump in market size because Marquette, Michigan would have been probably down in the lower 100s, maybe 180 market size. So I went to a market that was 38th in size. And of course, the goal of anybody in Michigan was to get to Detroit because it was the top 10. Once you get to the top 10 markets, you've got it made. But my big thing was I needed to stay close to Windsor so I could see my husband and son on weekends. So I restricted my jobs to the Michigan area. And after Grand Rapids at WZZM, the ABC affiliate, where they were also wonderful. Charles said he's fine holding, so don't. Oh, I guess there's someone who's on a call, but I'll ignore that until Mike or you say it's time to attend to it.
Go ahead.
From there, I went to work in Lansing, the capital, state capital, and I was the producer and anchor of the noon show, and then I'd go out and report on the Capitol for the 6 o'clock news. Very busy. None of the lazy crap that I experienced at the CBC that drove me crazy, where they had five people doing one person's job. The laziest, overpaid people are those who work for the Canadian Broadcasting Company, where they spend their time at lunch. They used to go over to the media club to drink. At night, they'd all get together. They wouldn't stay. Every newsroom I ever worked in the U.S., there was a sense of pride in our product. All the reporters, producers, everybody would stay around at 6 o'clock, and we'd watch the newscast together and comment on each other's work.
If I had to work the equipment, process the actual video, the physical tape, and do editing, cutting, that blows me away. I mean, I'm new generation. Everything that I have to, even for my documentaries that I've made, it's just been point and click. So inspire you for what?
Yeah, I mean, remember, this was 1978. And by the way, it was really hard for me to get over the border in 1978. Although I had my permanent resident card issued to me, and my husband and I and our son were going over the border together, they were in the truck carrying our furniture and got over the border because, of course, they're both American citizens. I went to the border. Compare that with today. Here I am coming out of Canada. I have a letter from the U.S. consulate in Canada saying, we have issued your permanent residence card. It should be in the mail. If you haven't received it, this letter should get you over the border. The border guard wouldn't let me over. He says, I've got ultimate discretion. If I don't want to let you over, you're not going over.
Yeah.
You gave up your residence in Canada. So basically, you don't have a residence. So I'm sorry, you can't come in. I said, wait a minute, I have nowhere to go. My husband and son are right there in front of me. He said, too bad, go back to Canada. So I had to go back, drive to Toronto, and go to the consulate there, get the card, and then drive back. And today, I mean, can you imagine? Here I was, the wife of an American, the mother of an American, and I couldn't get in with documentation from the U.S. Embassy and the consulate saying that I had my permanent resident status. Anyhow.
Well, in today, I mean, compare that situation with today where you have the drug trade. I mean, I've watched so many documentaries, especially about there in Detroit, for the people who just drive over the border every week, bring back a giant bag of ecstasy or heroin or whatever, never get searched by the drug dogs, same thing, and they make, you know, $10,000 to $25,000 a month just making four trips across the border every month.
Wow.
And it's like so yeah, and I've definitely had my troubles. My listeners know I've had my troubles traveling. I often get told that my ticket wasn't real. I get told that I have to have a visa to wherever I'm going. For me to get anywhere, it usually takes me either disclosing who I am, you know, because I either have to deal with security, which I tell them, hey, I'm media. I expose cops like you for a living. You want to keep going this way. And then if it's just somebody at the counter, I usually will just go to a different counter and hit on the lady that's there, and she does everything for me. So that's how I have to travel.
I can imagine it's frustrating. Now, here's something really ironic. But anyway, let me finish that. I worked for the PBS, then worked for WLUC, then worked for Grand Rapids, Michigan, the ABC affiliate, then Lansing TV, which was a wonderful, again, a wonderful, wonderful job. Loved it. Loved Grand Rapids, loved Marquette. The smaller markets were wonderful. It was when I got to New Orleans that the jealousy, the rivalry, the backstabbing, the malice, it was horrible. And worst of all, I was ignorant. I didn't understand the concept of the South still feeling that it's occupied by the North, that they have never had their reconstruction. I was ignorant of that. So I was resented for being a Northerner. Not that I was Canadian. I was a northerner. And then how dare I pronounce French the correct way? For example, yes. Canal Villery. I pronounced it. I made the terrible mistake of saying Canal Villere. I mean, that's the French pronunciation. Well, I got calls about that. You northerner, you know, or even the word Burgundy, putting the stress on the wrong syllable. They say Burgundy. I said Burgundy, or the French Quarter, French Quarter. And then I used to pronounce it New Orleans.
It's Nolens.
Yeah, Nolens, exactly. And then
I have family in Louisiana. Yeah.
Yeah, so you would know. And also, apparently, every neighborhood in Louisiana pronounces things differently. You can tell what neighborhood they're from. If they said, for example, instead of saying four, if they said four, you knew which neighborhood they were from.
Yep.
Actually, as hard as New Orleans was, it was a tremendous experience. But the amazing thing was that the Cajuns don't really speak, you know, we didn't understand their French. It was incomprehensible. But that's because a lot of them were the Cajuns who were chased out of Acadia in eastern Canada by the British. And the British were brutal. They absolutely genocided an entire tribe, starved them to death in the eastern part of Canada, then drove out the French, and they went down the coast and settled in different parts of the eastern coasts of the U.S., and then those who ended up in the bayous ended up becoming the Cajuns. So they would have spoken their own dialect and mixed with the Creole. And
most people think of Louisiana as Cajun. It's like, no, most of the term that you're hearing is Creole. You can't really understand the Cajuns.
No. And the French they speak there, you don't understand it. They're now in the universities at Tulane, I think, teaching modern standard French. But everything has been synthesized and revised so that there's a, quote, modern standard. Like there's a modern standard Arabic, which is a pretentious language. There's now a modern standard modern Hebrew, which is, again, a synthesized fake language. It's not the – and when I hear them refer to Hebrew as sacred, it's not it, – it was stolen from the Arameans. It's Aramaic and the Arameans. And that is – it's even – just go to Bible Hub and let me just give some of the – let me see if I can get to some of these. For example – things that we just mispronounce so badly. It's not the Tigris, it's the Tigris, because there's no I unless you have an AI in any of the dialects. And it was known as Daklat, which was the name of the dates. It's what they called the dates. And the Euphrates was Frata. And by the way, in Chaldean, it was the Tigris, but in Arabic, it was Dajla, which means flooding. Because like the Nile, it would flood the land.
Okay.
I can hear that. That sounds about right.
Yeah, definitely sounds about right. We are going to the top of the hour break here.
Okay.
We are going to – we'll take calls. We'll open up the call line. And, stay tuned, everybody.
We must take America back.
What would you say if I told you we have a new tool that will increase production and lower maintenance costs for your meat processing company, and it would pay for itself in just 6 weeks?
When pigs fly!
The new EaseOff Model EZ4 replaces old spring-style carcass droppers and is faster, safer, and more reliable. The EaseOff lowers or lifts 1,000 pounds to or from your rail automatically using our remote control.
Sounds expensive! Can I afford it?
Can you afford not to try the EaseOff? It installs fast with just 3 bolts in place of your current dropper. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue and injuries, speed up your line, eliminate downtime, and increase profit.
How can I order my Ease Off?
Go to easeoff.com, EAZEOFF.com, and hurry, because we are offering $200 off on the new Easy 4 for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too. EaseOff LLC, Summersville, Missouri. 417-932-6419.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio. Only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.